You are listening to Fanther Tracks.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Wolcaster.
That's not true. That's impossible.
Episode 48 of Making Tracks comes to you like an Ewok battle wagon out of control. My name's Mark Mulcaster, and with me today is Mr. Mark Newbold. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you for that wonderful introduction. How are you, Mark?
I'm good, man. Fresh off of the 9 hour or however long it was, viewing epic that was Empire 40.
It was fantastic. If you had the chance to watch it, you got a treat. And it was free. And if you haven't, go back and watch it. There were some phenomenal guests on there, wasn't there?
Yeah, it's still online. Yeah, we were really lucky because we were both involved, which if you saw it by now, I think you would have figured that one out because our little faces were all over that stream. So I was really fortunate enough to interview the editor on Empire Strikes Back as well as one of the editors on A New Hope. Both me and yourself interviewed Peter MacDonald, our second unit director on Empire. And then we had a great little chat with John Morton, Dak.
Yes.
And that was just one of the funnest interviews I've done in a long time.
Yeah.
In fact, they all were.
Well, you interviewing Paul Hirsch was awesome. That, I mean, to get a conversation with him was really, really cool.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's always handy when the person has a book out and you can say, oh, yeah, promote your book. But the thing is, I think even Peter MacDonald mentions this in the interview, is actually, you know, we speak to these professionals from the film industry about one film, and all of them have had these massive film and movie and TV careers. But it always comes back to Star Wars. That's what people want to talk about. And I think we're lucky that they are willing to sit down with us and have a chat. Now, with how everybody's a lot more comfortable using stuff like Zoom and that, it's made it so much more easier.
It has. I mean, we were very lucky to get the people that we got. I mean, we also, if you listen to Cannon Fodder, which of course you should, we've got some special episodes coming up from Empire 40. We've got a chat that we both did with Jonathan Rinsler, J.W. Mm-hmm. Rinsler, who, as you've just mentioned, funny enough, is promoting his new book called All Up, about the space race in the 50s. And that looks fascinating. We'll be bringing a review of that to the site very soon. And also, I was lucky enough, and it was big thing for me to speak to Walt Simonson, the Marvel writer and artist, best known for his about 18-month run on Star Wars back in the early 80s between Empire and Jedi. So that was fascinating chat. So yeah, we were very lucky. But like you say, Zoom has been an absolute godsend. I mean, just, yeah. And it's all comes in. I'd never even heard of Zoom before the whole corona outbreak. And it's such a completely normal part of our life now to be in with everything else. It's just completely come out. It's the one good thing to come out of 2020, I think, so far.
Yeah, it's great. And like you said, for us, it's going to create some extra content because actually we're able to have extended versions of the content which went out on Empire 40. So those will be dropping as and when we can get a chance to fit them in the schedule.
Absolutely, yes. So as you've just said, the Paul Hirsch interview will be coming to Fanther on Making Tracks. Walt Simonson and J.W. Rinsler will be going on to Cannon Fodder with special episodes. The chat we had with Dak, with John Morton, will be coming here to Making Tracks, and with Peter MacDonald, Madeline Most. And there's some other bits as well. So it's not just that. There's more content as well. So yeah, loads to come from Empire 40. The show was finished 2 days ago, but it's still there. It's not going anywhere. Again, big thanks to Dave, who was a guest on our last episode, and Simon for all the stellar work they did and for involving us in the event once again. And we're thrilled to be a part of it and looking forward to doing it again.
You're listening to Fanther Tracks. Flip through the galaxy of literature with Cannon Fodder hosts Ryan Cameron, Matt Booker, Mark Newbold, and Mark Mulcaster.
Count me in.
Spin round the rim with Desert Planet Discs, your musical journey through the space lanes with your hosts, Carl Bayless and Greg Robertson.
The hottest tunes this side of Mos Eisley.
Hot dang!
Get the latest news, interviews, reviews, and much more on Making Tracks with your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
Like an Ewok battle wagon out of control.
Join hosts Claire Henry and a rotating panel of guest hosts for the podcast that's full of hope.
Hope.
Planet Leia.
I love you.
I know.
It's time to head south with the Fanther from Down Under, Adam O'Brien.
Oh, g'day, mate. How you going?
Start Your Engines with Paul Naylor and Mark Newbold as they lift the hood on starships, airspeeders, swoops, capital ships, and more from across the cosmos. And for everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds, bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
So we're joined on Making Tracks today by Becca Benjamin. You will know Becca from her appearances and hosting of Tarkin's Top Shelf, Kanata's Castle, and being part of the Planet Leia team here on Fantha Trucks Radio. Becca, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. It's great to talk to you again. I think the last time we actually sat down and had a conversation back and forth was Celebration. So it's been quite some time.
It has been a time, and we've missed out on a Celebration this year, haven't we? We should have had another one, but a couple of years to go for that one. And it's been a while since we've spoken on a podcast, so I'm really looking forward to digging into our topic of conversation, which is Shmi Skywalker. Now, as we were talking before we started recording, obviously Rise of Skywalker's come out. There's more definition to the history of Rey, and as a consequence to the history of the Skywalkers as a whole and their connections to the Palpatine lineage, if you want to call it that. But Shmi is a particular character that's never really been, to any great degree anyway, defined. And it just feels like there's room for stories, room for extra information to come out. And I wanted to pick your brains about it because I know she's a character you're passionate about. So what would you like to say before we really get into it about the character of Shmi Skywalker? What does she mean to you?
Oh, she means a great deal. Wow, because I've talked about this in different ways through other podcasts and through my own. Shmi is one of those characters that I really think we overlook, and I don't think it's done purposefully. I just think it's because we really only get most of her in one film, and we get a little bit of her in another, but again, she's not a constant, if that makes sense. You know, she really is the beginning of our hero of the entire Skywalker saga. I mean, this is where she come from, you know, where Anakin and Luke begin. You know, this is where their lineage starts. As far as we see, we don't know, you know, the rest of the Skywalker family and how that got into where they are. All we know is that Shmi and Anakin, when Anakin was around 2 years of age, were bought by Gerdula the Hutt, and brought to Tatooine. And then she lost them in a bet with Watto. And that's all we really know. We don't know how that exchange began, if Shmi was a slave her entire life, or how that even happened, or if Skywalker is really the birth name, or in an example like Han Solo, was that a name that she picked up, yeah, you know, and took on, or very similar to Rey, a name that she decided, well, you know, this is as closest to my family as I've gotten, you know, a family that I established for myself. So I'm going to take hold of this name. So we don't know. There's a lot out there. And it all points to Shmi.
George always said, oh, Skywalker's as common a name as Smith. But that was always a fudge to cover up the fact that Luke didn't change his name and he lived on Tatooine, which is now the focal point of so many of the stories. Does it surprise you then, given that Shmi has this sort of keystone part in the whole Skywalker story, that she hasn't been investigated more? Or do you think it's because the galaxy is just so big and the story was always moving forward that maybe to delve into Shmi requires a little bit of stepping back and looking at that history?
I think it's a little bit of both, but I think we're at a time now where the fandom is interested in that era. I mean, look at now, all these years have gone by since the prequels, and we're just now starting to get books of Padme Amidala. It always felt like George kept her, even Padme, like under lock and key, right? Yeah. We didn't want to go too far into that, but now we're starting to get more of her story. So I think it only makes sense that they would dive into that. I mean, I'm really hoping we start to get that because there is a lot to explore with Shmi. There's a lot of unanswered questions. And now, looking at her after all 9 films now, and even after reading things like Queen's Peril and Queen's Shadow and things of that nature, and then going back and watching these films, they almost change because of this backstory now that we have. And you look at Shmi, I think, a little differently. There's a lot to me now when you watch her and just the way she sneaks in the shadows, listening to Qui-Gon talk to her son. It's like she knows things.
Yeah.
And she's looking for that affirmation that she's been right all this time. I think she knows more than she lets on. And I think Qui-Gon knows that, but doesn't push. He's a different Jedi. We all know this, you know, after reading other books about him. We do know where he stands, and he was trying to be more similar to what Ahsoka is in season 7 of the Clone Wars. He's not political. He tries to stay away from that. He tries to gear himself towards the spiritual side of the Force and not what they have turned themselves into as terms of what Jedi are at that point in time. So I think he looks at it that way, and again, not trying to push her. I do believe there's a lot more to Shmi that meets the eye.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you look at, I mean, Qui-Gon, there's a 1,000 podcasts you could do just talking about Qui-Gon and the influence he would have had if he hadn't have been taken down by Maul. And you think, you look at Shmi, and I always think with her, we meet her as a slave and Anakin, as a pair, the two of them together, very close. But she understands he's got a destiny he needs to follow that's not on the cut in or in the cards for her. That's not part of her journey being a Jedi. But I always thought, I wonder whether she was always downtrodden, hard bitten, lived a rough and hard life, kind of like Rey did to a point, you know, for those years until she meets Finn and the adventure begins. She's living a hard life. Did Shmi always live a hard life? Or do you think maybe she came from a different history, that she'd had turns in her life that led her to this sort of life of almost like servitude, really?
You know, it's quite possible. I would honestly, from if I was to be the one to pick up the story and go with it, I would love it to be a full circle moment where Rey and Shmi almost parallel one another, and where they follow very similar lifestyles, because it would bring that much more meaning to the end of the saga, because it's almost like the circle is now complete, because Rey brings it all back to Shmi, you know, that hard life, and it comes all back to her. Because in a sense, we've always felt that Star Wars was almost like a patriarch, correct? But if you look at how it ends, it almost ends the opposite, almost where the mother carries the mantle. And you see this now, if you look at it where Shmi and Rey are very similar in a sense of lifestyle and where they end up, it would make sense for Rey to bring it all back. You know, the mother now finally is, again, her circle is finished, because she is with not only her son now at rest, she's with her grandchildren. You know, I think that's a beautiful sentiment, because it's not bringing it home to the father anymore, where we ended in episode 6. You know, it all harkened back to Anakin. Well, now it's harkening back to Shmi. And I think that's beautiful. And it would make sense in a way if Shmi had to go into, like you said, like a servitude, almost like a solitude, to hide from where she really came from, in a way. And especially if she did it on her own and chose that, again, choosing, that's such a big thing in Star Wars. I've always rated these films as the three C's. You know, it's choice, change, and then it leads to cost. And that's where these characters always go. The choices that they make cause that change, and then eventually they pay the ultimate price for those choices. So, and I can see this happening, and I think it would be beautiful to bring that story full circle in that way. If Shmi did have to run from something, and the only way to do it, like you said, was to struggle. I mean, there's a lot of talk going on now where, well, why would Rey's parents, of all choices to make to keep her safe, sell her to Unkar Plutt? Couldn't they find a close confidant and put her somewhere else? You know, so there's a lot of that going on. So it's like, okay, it'd be one thing if the character chose it, right? So
yeah,
there's a lot there. I really think Shmi's story needs to come out. And I think that would definitely, again, change how we look at these stories and these films, because that's the beauty of Star Wars. You can't really go into any other movie franchise and see these movies differently. And they seem to change with every new added layer, whether it be a video game, a book, a comic book, because now that Darth Vader series is coming out, and that's just crazy. But I mean, you know, so how it ties, I really do feel that's the beauty of Star Wars, is those connections.
I'm Gareth Edwards, and you're listening to Making Tracks on Fanthatrax Radio.
Yeah, it feels like with Shmi, I mean, just what you've said feels like that's just scratching the surface, and there's so much underneath that you could delve into. And also, just as fans, you know, it's such an interesting era, but you kind of feel like there's definitely stories to tell in terms of, like you say, you know, where did she come from? Why did she get there? And as you've just said, I love the three C's. That's a great concept. You know, what choices did she make? Because we know the cost, you know, mm-hmm. we saw the cost. But, you know, what choices did she make to get there? And if you parallel her with Ray, as you say, it makes more sense the more you say it. They are the two parallel characters more than almost anybody else. And also, was she born with the Skywalker name? Or did she make a conscious decision like Ray did all those, you know, decades later to take the name? There's a lot in there to unpack if you really want to get into it.
Oh, I agree. And there's always that other question, which I've always asked myself. Was Shmi graced with Force? I mean, yeah. I've always leaned towards yes. I think what leans me towards that are two things. It's what Kleeglar says to Anakin when he comes, you know, looking for her, that there's no way she's lasted as long as she has. She's been out there a month. Okay. Yeah. So they're basically saying there's no human being that could have, you know, survived that torture for a month, but yet she has.
Yeah.
And it's only until she sees her son that she can let go.
Yeah.
Again, the letting go aspect, that's huge in Star Wars.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also the dreams. I don't believe Anakin seeing his mother at that point, especially now taking the whole saga all at hand now. I don't think that was a dream. I really think that was her reaching out to him, trying to show him where she's at. Almost very similar to, you know, Kylo and Rey's force timing or force yeah. Skyping, whatever you want to call it. I think yeah. it was a version of that. I think she really was calling to him.
That's
so.
A really fascinating call. I've never thought of that, but it makes a lot of sense when you say it like that, because Shmi's that much older, obviously. So Yoda said that Anakin was too late to start training, let alone, you know, Shmi, if ever the opportunity had come to her. But, yeah, it's that choice thing again that you say, you know, she's... Anakin's only, what is he, 9 at the time of Phantom Menace? So certainly mm-hmm. for that sort of 9 or 10 years, and while she was carrying him, puts him first and he becomes the priority in her life and becomes almost even more the priority when she lets him go. But you've got to wonder whether or not that was ever part of her, or could have been part of her destiny. I said earlier, I don't think it was, but now you're saying that, it's like, well, actually, maybe. It's another one of those conscious choices. She's decided... that's not for me. She's very forthright about saying, you know, about the Republic. The Republic don't exist out here. So the Republic and the Jedi are sort of tied completely together. They're synonymous with each other. So maybe that's just her, maybe not a political decision or a political opinion, but it's just her looking at the world just as it is. What good are they when we're all the way out here starving and living off the sand, when, you know, there's opulence and richness all around other parts of the galaxy, but nobody seems to care about us. And Tatooine does feel like the place where people go if they want to get away from everything and hide from anyone. So given that, then, what would you like to see if a Shmi project, be it book, comic, TV, whatever, came to be?
Well, there's two things. Obviously, I would love to see her younger and leading up to her pregnancy with Anakin. I would like to see those early years, you know, how she became Shmi Skywalker, the slave, you know, were there siblings, you know, did she have parents, you know, what was that situation there? Were they always slaves? You know, was that what she was born into? You know, did she have some sort of sensitivity of the Force where she refused it? I mean, we do know there are stories out there, regardless if they're legends, there's stories out there that not all of them accept the call, right? Yeah. So some of them just don't. I mean, even there's a book out there, Force Collector, you know, Carr. He has sensitivity, but not in a Jedi way. Mm. Yes, he can touch things and see their past and, you know, where they've been, but it's just not strong enough to become a Jedi Knight. So, but again, she could just have some sort of Force sensitivity, but not in that way.
Yeah.
I'm not that strong level, but to some degree. So I would like to see them, those beginning years with her and where she ends up, where she is. But I would also, very similar to what they're talking about with the Kenobi series, I would like to see her life with Kleeglars and young Owen. I would like to see what that 10 years was like for her. There is one book out there that is no longer canon. It's Legends, and that's Tatooine Ghost, I believe. And I love that she made a chronicalized audio kind of diary where she kept a journal every day, you know, speaking to her son in hopes that somehow, some way he would see those. So he would know how much he meant to her and how much she always thought of him.
Yeah.
I think that's beautiful sentiment. And I think, again, because again, what are you going to do with Kenobi, right? For 20 years, he's on the dust ball. He's on Tatooine. So it's a similar thing. I mean, so I would love to get that. So there's two things there that I would really love to see play out. I think there's tie-ins to lore if you go with Shmi. There has to be. I mean, she's the mother of the Chosen One. I mean, in a biblical sense, she's the Blessed Mary.
Sure.
If you look at it that way.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, the Force bestowed upon her Anakin.
And there's got to be a reason. Yeah, there's got to be a reason.
Why did he choose her?
Yeah. And if Palpatine, I mean, there's another theory as well. The whole Palpatine theory in that relationship, if there was one, why would he choose her? If he did choose her, where were the connections there? She does feel like somebody that came, the more you say it out loud, and this is the first time I've had a conversation about Shmi on a podcast, so the more you think about it, the more you talk about it, the more it feels like she's come from somewhere significant. She's a person of, not influence, but almost, was it Mace kind of referred to Anakin as a verger in the Force sort of thing, like he's a focal point. And maybe it just in life, maybe Shmi is a similar sort of character where, you know, certain people in history, everything revolves around them without them almost knowing it's happening. And it almost feels like that with Shmi, the more you say it out loud. And you say it about her being almost, well, I think we used to call it Force sensitive, didn't we? It's an old, like an old West End Games kind of logic. You know, people don't use the Force. They can't do things with the Force. They can't lift rocks and all the other things that Force, attuned, trained Force users can do. Apart from the very few innate ones like Anakin, who, you know, the only human that could do it in a pod race and all that sort of stuff. But maybe if Shmi can put her thoughts and emotions out there, Anakin is so powerful within it that he's picking it up and it's amplified to him. Wow, there's really a lot of meat on the bone when you start digging into it.
Right. And, you know, the more I listen to you talk about it, think about what you just said about Shmi being more possibly connected through her thoughts and feelings. That was Leia.
Mm.
Leia was more attuned to the Force in that way, which does make her, in a way, stronger.
Yeah.
Because she can keep those feelings and all that all in check. So could Shmi. It would make sense that that is where that strength comes from. Because if you read the novelizations, both the junior and the adult version of The Rise of Skywalker, Luke actually talks about how different Leia's traits are with the Force.
Yeah.
That calmness and to be able to feel things more thoroughly than others. Shmi was very similar. Like if you look at the way she holds it all in the Phantom Menace, especially when she lets her son go, I would be falling apart. I mean, I have three kids. Granted, they're for the most part grown now, but I cannot imagine letting one of them go at the age of 9. Yeah, sure. You're going to be better off there. I'm never going to see you again. Good luck.
Yeah.
No way. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Where does that strength come from? But think about it. That's Leia. When she goes to Yavin 4, you know, and they all want to, you know, be at her side because of what happened to Alderaan. She goes, we don't have time for Star Wars now. Mm-hmm. That is so Shmi. Like, think about it.
Yeah. I hope somebody's thinking about this because, like you say, Padme is now being investigated. We had the Age of Republic comic story with Padme, which had a bit of focus on her in there, which was great. I really enjoyed that story. And as you said, the two E.K. Johnston books. And so that character's getting the investigation that she maybe she's always deserved it. But it almost feels like you've just said now the 9 stories are done, that there's a broader understanding of the circle, if you want to say that. I know that was the whole Revenge of the Sith sort of line, but now with the 9, it sort of wraps it around even more. But now we know more. Now you're on more solid ground to go back and investigate a character like Padme without fear of contradiction later on down the line. And it feels like now Shmi could be a similar character that could really be dug into and looked at, because we're talking about it now for what, 20 minutes, you know, about a character that's on screen for not that long And as you say, in Attack of the Clones is in one scene in the Tusken village. But the influence of her character, the effect that she has on, obviously, more on Anakin than anyone, but similar traits with Leia. I'd never considered that, but it's quite apparent when you start vocalising it. There's definitely something there that needs following up. Recently, an interesting rumour came about, and it is just a rumour. There's no facts behind it at all, but it was an interesting point that I thought bared more investigation. Future Star Wars budgets will be reduced, presumably because of the effects of what's been going on recently with COVID and coronavirus and such, and the strain that it's put on the movie and TV industry. But also possibly because technology is changing and advancing, and it gives them more options to make quality television at a lower price. Mark, what do you think? Do you think it's a possibility that future Star Wars productions will maybe scale it back a bit because the story dictates it, or maybe because the technology allows it? What do you think?
I think it could be a bit of both. I mean, what will be interesting, I think, for me, is actually knowing how much the stagecraft technology costs. Say if you were to do a film and use, let's say, 50% of all your sets are going to be in the stagecraft.
Yeah.
How much would that cost? And also, actually, because at the moment, it is of a certain size. Now, will films need it to be bigger? Suppose if you've got a bigger cast, then maybe you'll need to have a bigger volume. Or maybe that doesn't even come into it, because maybe you're just going to go, you know what, we're not going to have 200 stormtroopers, we're going to have 20 stormtroopers, and the other 180 are going to be in the volume as CG characters. And I do wonder if that is possibly the driving force behind it. I wonder if they're actually putting a lot of stock into that. Obviously, films cost a lot to make these days, but not only do they cost a lot to make, they cost a lot to market, and that can actually be one of the things that makes or breaks the film. Obviously, if the film's no good, with the nature of the world these days, it can have one single preview and people can say this is absolutely rubbish, so don't go and see it, and therefore that's it, your box office returns are next to nothing, because, like, you know, word of mouth got out, but actually it's not good. I wonder also if there is the impact of COVID-19, and they're thinking that for the, you know, the short-term foreseeable future, be it 18 months or 2 years, there may be a reduction in the number of people who are confident enough and willing to go to a cinema to view a film. So therefore, yeah, your box office numbers will go down from that reason alone.
We've seen it, we talked about it on a previous episode, but, you know, you've seen a lot of films that were clearly slated for the big screen come out on the small screen. I mean, like Onward, I think the Pixar film had a very limited cinema release and then came to Disney Plus in the States, and Greyhound, the Tom Hanks film, turned up on Apple TV as opposed to big screen, which I know he was disappointed about because he really wanted to see it on the big screen. But you think, yeah, I mean, if they can make the money. Oh, we talked about Extraction the other day, you know, yeah, the crazy numbers that Extraction had, you know, on Netflix, like 99 million views or whatever it was, you know, which would translate to like $1 billion at the box office at 10 bucks a ticket, and more than 10 bucks a ticket, but you know what I mean. It would have been very substantial numbers. But it feels like confidence is the real thing. And it also feels like we've been saying on the show for months now whilst we've been recording in lockdown, and we're kind of sort of easing out the back of it now. How life has changed whilst we've been doing this show, and how things have been, we all, you know, we're always talking about that, and how things are going to be and how life will change. And you look at the movie industry and you think, well, is it one of those perfect storm moments? And it might not be the perfect storm moment for certain members of the film industry, because it might mean you need less guys to go out on location. It might mean you need less set builders and all that, the ancillary stuff that at the moment are completely necessary. You know, when Lucas really was at the forefront of pushing digital filmmaking, you always had people like Spielberg who wanted to edit on film, and Scorsese who wanted to use, you know, he would never shoot in digital, and he'd rather spend $2 million on sets than have ILM build it as a digital backlot. You know, you're always going to have filmmakers that want that flexibility, but by the same token, now stagecraft to a different level, because it's much broader in scope, and your point about a bigger volume is a good point. You know, you think as the definition of the screens is only going to get better and bigger and more detailed, you know, so they probably will be able to make it enormous and look immersive.
This is Steve Bloom, voice of Zebraelios, and you're listening to Fanthatrax Caravast. May the Force be with you.
There's a massive assumption, specifically on my part, that, well, stagecraft has got to be cheaper, hasn't it? It's got to be cheaper. How could it not be cheaper? It's not necessarily the case, is it? You know, at this point, especially at this point early on, what was expensive when they were making the original Clone Wars animated series is probably off the shelf now. So tech moves on.
and hardware moves on, doesn't it? You know, so
yeah,
you know, I'm assuming that it's cheaper to make a Stagecraft set, a virtual Stagecraft set, than it is to actually build the damn set. Might not be the case. It's just an assumption on my behalf. It just feels like it would be. And maybe it is, I don't know. But it just feels like the rise of that tech now and what's happening in the real world with COVID and what's going to happen afterwards. And you just saying the big word, the C word, confidence. Are the crowds going to have confidence to go back to the cinema? Are companies like Disney going to have the confidence to spend $250 million on a massive budget for a Star Wars film? Because goodness knows, Solo costs that. You know, Rise of Skywalker costs that. Force Awakens costs $200. Rogue One costs $200. Last Jedi costs pretty much that. You know, they're all high $200+. That's a lot of money. And then, like you say, you're going to market the damn thing as well. It's a tremendous spend. So confidence is the key, isn't it, at the moment?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, we could be seeing a shift, you know, that films may be now more legitimately being released. I know some of the actors may not like it, but the streaming services are a legitimate, you know, area and place to dream, like, you know, films. And not, you know, we're not just talking about made for TV films. We're talking about real quality actors and a solid script. Extraction wasn't really that, mind you, but it was a good film to watch on a Sunday. But
but they've just announced Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington are doing something on, was it Apple or Netflix, one of the streamers, and Denzel Washington and Julia Roberts, like two major Oscar winners, massive movie stars, essentially doing a TV show. You'd never have dreamed of that 15 years ago, let alone 20 years ago, whatever.
Exactly, and that is because of a shift in TV production quality. And this all comes down to the fact that the cameras that you shoot high-end TV series are the same cameras that you shoot films on. So the quality in the production is there. You could put Game of Thrones on the cinema and you say it's a film. That's easy, hands down. But also, we're in this era where, like, celebrity has changed, and the kind of celebrity that we get now is very instantaneous. You know, the Hollywood movie stars from like the 50s and 60s were around for like forever and were big names. They always got the draw, but there's so many actors and so many people who could be in a film that actually a lot of these older actors now, Denzel Washington and Julia Roberts, who's been, can't remember when Pretty Woman came out, that would have been, what, 80, mid-80s or something. So that's...
Yeah, 1990, I think, yeah.
There you go. And they've always said that it's, you know, it's a struggle for aging actors to get roles. Before, they probably wouldn't consider TV. TV and streaming looks equally as good. And it gives a different flexibility because, obviously, if you're doing a film, you are generally confined to, at the most, let's say, 3 hours or 3.5 hours. And that has to be a pretty good film to hold people's attention for that long.
Yeah.
Most films are still 2 hours, 2 hours 20 and that. But let's take Kenobi, for instance. You can entice Ewan McGregor back to say you can play this character for 2 hours, of which you're probably going to be in, let's say, 80%. Or we can do 12 hours and we can do two series on Netflix and it's going to look equally as good and you might get paid the same amount, all in all.
Televisions, I'm looking at my telly, I've got a 40-inch. It's a big telly. And there's plenty of tellies out there that are way bigger than that and better quality and everything else. And our next telly, it ain't going to be smaller. It's only going to be bigger. So the screen, the canvas that you're watching these streamers on only gets bigger and better quality and better defined. The sound gets better and everything. So the tech improves. So they look more substantial. So to put a big screen movie with all that detail on an old television, you might think, well, that's a waste. But you put it on a telly like that and it's like you're going to see everything like you would at the cinema, and you're at home and you can pause it and all the other stuff. But also for actors, I think the way television's going to go eventually is that the big screen will be for your major blockbusters, your big action blockbusters, your animated stuff, and your character stuff will go onto the streamers because you've got an actor like, well, we've just said them, Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington. Both can do action, both can do drama, they can do everything. They're Oscar winners, they can do everything. But it kind of feels like that will be the forum for their kind of work. But the big screen, funny enough, I've got Sky on right now in the background and they're just showing the trailer that you're bringing Force Awakens back onto the television. And that feels like that needs to be seen on a screen that I have to literally crick my neck from left to right to see everything, you know, because it's that kind of experience. It's an experience. But now, you're thinking for major movie companies, are they going to want to spend 200 plus. You know, it worked pre-COVID. It worked. Look at the Avengers. The money they spent on Endgame and Infinity War was astronomical. But one brings in $2 billion, just over, and the next one brings in nearly three. It's the biggest movie ever. So those two films brought in pushing $5 billion between the two films, and probably cost half a billion to make the two films. You've got to speculate to accumulate, but companies have got to be under such pressure right now after COVID financially. Like we said a minute ago, 2020 is a write-off for the film industry and probably for a lot of television as well. You know, it's just been a duff year. Keep as many stuff as they can, just keep their heads down and get through it. But you think, are they going to want to do that going forward? They're going to want to spend that sort of money.
I think it'd be interesting to see what the first billion-dollar box office film is after COVID.
Yeah, it really will. And stepping back to the point of this question, Star Wars films, do you think they'll make Star Wars films cheaper? I mean, I think you certainly could. But we've been talking about this so much on the show over the past few weeks, that the opportunity that doing a Disney Plus extended, longer form, episodic thing feels like right now, I never thought it would, but feels like right now, that feels like the right place for Star Wars. If you did a series where you could bring Han and Lando, Kira and Darth Maul and other characters back in on a weekly format, strewn over a longer stretch of time, cancel culture being what it is, you said something really interesting a minute ago about how you can have one preview, and if the preview sucks and the word gets out, this film's another Cats, then that, for whatever the film is, it's sunk before it starts. There's nothing's bulletproof now. Even Star Wars isn't bulletproof now. Nothing is bulletproof if Star Wars isn't bulletproof. So any major franchise can hit a big hurdle. So if you have one bad review and next morning it's all over Twitter and then Instagram and everywhere else, that's an impossible hurdle to get over. It doesn't matter how many hundreds of millions you throw at marketing it. It's the way of the world. It's the technology changing. It's a post-corona landscape. And money, it's a difficult one. But I can see them doing reduced budgets for Star Wars. I think that's quite possible. But everything, you know, because George did it, goodness knows, George did everything on a budget when Star Wars was an independent company. You think the new movie, you know, Force Awakens cost twice what any of the prequels did. Even Revenge of the Sith, I think, was like $120 million. In 2005, you're only going 10 years forward and it's 2.5 times the cost. It's a massive step up.
Thanks to Becca for joining Mark. That was a really interesting chat. Did you enjoy that?
I did. She really knows her stuff. She's definitely very invested in the character, the prequel era, and specifically Shmi. I can just tell the passion for the character from that conversation. So thanks to Becca for hopping on and joining us for this episode.
And I think that's probably all we've got time for today. So, Mark, do you want to do the usual and tell everybody how and where and when and why they can get in touch with us?
Why they can get in touch with us? Why? If only why.
Well, there is a why, isn't there? There's, you know, if you leave a review, you get a shout out.
That's very true. Yeah. Yes, leave a review and you get a shout out. It's very true. But if you do want to be part of the action and stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news, please visit FanthaTracks.com, which is the hub of all things FanthaTracks, or check out the FanthaTracks app through the App Store, and you can follow us on your mobile device. You can reach out to us and send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@FanthaTracks.com. Please do. We've got episode 50 coming up very soon, which we're hoping will be a bit of a blockbuster. So send in the questions. Comment, like, and share on any of our social media feeds at FanthaTracks, and be sure to subscribe and leave that review, preferably a 5-star one, on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And if you do, we'll give you a lovely big fat juicy shout out. Thank you again, Mark, and we'll see you next episode.
Yeah, you take care, everybody. Stay safe.
Coming up next on FanthaTracks Radio, it's another episode of Making Tracks.